We are just down the road from the Salk Institute. We're at the Estancia La Jolla Hotel and Spa, which is just next to the Salk and is very convenient. And we're with Chuck Stevens, professor in the Molecular Neurobiology Laboratory. And we're going to talk to you about this trajectory of yours, understanding the brain. I want to get a sense of Chuck Stevens' brain, or Chuck Stevens' sense of the brain. You did an interview with Nick Spitzer some time ago on UCSD TV, and he began by calling you a neuroscientist's neuroscientist who spots key problems and solves them with imagination and elegance. And I think I could find a lot of people who would agree to that. How did you actually get interested in brain to begin with? What was the beginning of all of that?
When I went to college, I wanted to be a doctor.
This was at Harvard initially.
It was at Harvard, yeah. And I knew nothing about medicine. Nobody in my family was a doctor. But when I was a child, and I would be sick at home, I would listen to a soap opera called Young Dr. Malone. And this got me thinking about it. And you know, if you're going to be a doctor, it's very safe. You don't have to worry about things. You don't have to make decisions in college. And so I went there thinking I was going to be a doctor. But I really didn't like the biology courses I had to take at the time. And I took and there was a course I had to take called something about reading, a reading and writing course that all the freshmen had to take. And in that, we read a brief thing about Freud, and I had never heard of Freud before. I was disadvantaged in my high school, and I'd never heard of Freud, and I found it incredibly interesting. And so I went to the psychology department and talked to the person there who was the advisor. His name was Floyd Ratliff. And I asked him what you did in psychology, and he said, well, there are two things. At Harvard, there was social relations and psychology, and that psychology was the more scientific of the one, although the other one was where they did the Freud stuff. And I asked him, is it possible to major in psychology and still go to medical school so I wouldn't have to take all of that biology and chemistry things? And he said, yes, it was. Many people did it. And so I took a psychology course, and I really liked it. Mm-hmm. It was so interesting, and much more interesting than things I've later gotten to love, but not at the time. And so I did, I went through and took a physiological psychology course. And we talked a lot about the brain and at the time about Hebb, and I got caught up in learning theory and in physiological psychology as an undergraduate. Then I thought, well, gee, maybe I'll just, I was excited about psychology, and I thought maybe I'll just go to graduate school in psychology. But around the time I had to decide, the thing I was most excited about was statistical learning theory. There was a book by Bush and Mosteller called Stochastic Models for Learning, and it was all the rage for a while. And by the time it was time to make up my mind, I had decided that it was sort of sterile. And so I fell back on my plan to go to medical school. Mm-hmm. I went to medical school, and I went to Yale, and Yale was the medical school that was the least constraining. There were the fewest number of courses you had to take, and you could take electives, and we had one day a week for starting the first year completely free. And so I spent that day a week working in a neurophysiology laboratory with a guy named Jerry Sutton, who had come from UCLA. And so I got caught up in doing research in neurobiology. And I also took courses in some graduate courses as electives in medical school.
Terry Sanofsky asked me to ask you two questions. Why did you go to Yale? Why did you leave Yale?
What you mean, did I go there for medical school or did I go there for...
There was a teaching thing later, but we shall get to that later.
Oh. You mean afterwards as a faculty member? Mm. The reason I went there was because we were in Seattle and I didn't think I'd ever stay in Seattle. I thought it was just a place I would go for a while, but I actually loved it there. Mm. I really hated to leave. But we were getting close to 40 years old, and my wife, who is a music historian, we were waiting for someone to die or retire there. No one ever did, and for her to get a job. She had a job all the time when she was there. It would be pickup jobs. She'd be filling in for somebody in the music history who had left to go finish up his dissertation, and she had her PhD from Yale, which is a very very good music history department, and she did all sorts of things. She had a job every year, but it was never a real job. And so I told her that I would go wherever she got a job. And she got a job at Yale, and so I went there. Mm-hmm. And why did I leave? The reason I left was because I was on an advisor to the president, Fred DeHoffman, at Salk. I had been for years. I'd come every year and I'd go around and talk to people and tell him what I thought the state of things were and what the relations between people were and what the problems were. And every year he would ask me, didn't I want to come? And and I always said, no, I couldn't leave Yale. And I had been offered a job at MIT when I was at Yale, and I came this close to going, but for various reasons I didn't go. Partly because my wife's job wasn't as good up there as the one at Yale. Partly because we were going to lose money changing houses, and partly because I couldn't figure out what the power structure there was, and I was worried I was going to spend all my time doing politics instead of science. So. Yale made a department for me called molecular neurobiology to keep me at Yale, and they made a bunch of promises, and so I stayed, and they renovated a place. In fact, they had a place that was where my office was. When I was a medical student, I'd had a patient just where my desk was. And it was kind of funny because they had renovated it completely. It was quite beautiful, but very small. And the dean that got this organized for me and got me to stay made promises and left. And then a new dean came, and he systematically broke all the promises that the first dean made. I decided that the whole group of us was going to move to Johns Hopkins. And they had the space down there for us, and it was going to be a Howard Hughes Institute we could all go to. And I told the dean I was leaving, and he said, well, maybe we got off on the wrong foot here. And so he made a bunch of more promises, all of which he systematically broke over time. And the worst one was that everybody where we were supposed to have double the space after a while, but the space that we had, everybody had 400 square feet of laboratory space and 60 square feet of office space. I had 500 square feet of laboratory space and a little bit more office space, and that was just because of the way things worked out in the arrangement. And my assistant professors were competing with people who had much more space, and they could work around problems that they had. And one of the things that the dean promised me was more space, and he gave me temporary space. But then he said, well, he had to take it back now. And I said, where shall I put my people? And he said, well, wherever they came from, I don't know. Mm. And so At that moment, Fred de Hoffman called me, his yearly call.
He was president of the Salkins.
Yes, and I said, Fred, let's talk about this.
So when did you come to the Salkins?
1990. And this happened in 1990. It took about a year to get
organized. We jumped ahead a little bit there. I wanted to get that in because we're in these conversations. We very rarely talk about these sort of practical issues that scientists face. I actually do ask people, what's your advice to a young scientist, and so on and so forth. But there are these fundamental issues of things like, how much space have you got, and are people actually keeping up, and the internal politics, all those sorts of things that I think young scientists need to be apprised of as well. So I wanted to bring that out before I forgot it. But let's circle back again, because after you've done your MD at Yale, and again, we're in this because, not because you had parents who were scientists or interested in anything like that or anything.
I had a doctor that I admired in the little town I lived in at the time in North Carolina, and young Dr. Maloon on the radio.
Right.
And that was.
So you end up going to Yale to do an MD.
Yeah.
Are you thinking of using the psychology at this point and maybe becoming a physician of some kind?
So my plan was to be what's now called a physician scientist. I was going to go into clinical medicine, and I really liked my clinical medicine. It was I loved my patients. I enjoyed it enormously, but then I also enjoyed my research because I did a lot of research when I was in medical school. I went to Woods Hole as a grass fellow for a summer at Woods Hole. I worked every summer doing research, and there were at Yale they had time set out for doing research. And I got so caught up in research, and then I started to realize that I couldn't do both well. That the kind of research that I liked and the kind of clinical medicine I liked didn't match up. And I really liked internal medicine. I found psychiatry. I didn't like psychiatry when I did that. It was interesting, but I didn't want to do it all the time. I didn't want to be a neurologist. And I thought, if you're a physician, you have to know everything that you need to know for the good of your patients. And as a scientist, you need to know everything you can possibly know for the good of your science. And if they don't match up right, then you can't do it both. And so after this agonizing decision, it was really agonizing, I decided to leave clinical medicine and go to graduate school. And so then I went to Rockefeller.
Went to the Rock,
And I went there mainly, I thought, to learn math and physics because I thought I needed to know that, and I was too ignorant. And so I went to Rockefeller and mostly did courses in math and physics.
So you had the MD, you then get a PhD.
Yeah.
And you mentioned earlier the interest in HEB and so on and so forth. So you're already thinking about circuitries
and
the things that you've...
In fact, what I was going to do was the year that I was a first-year graduate student at Rockefeller, they were trying a new thing, and we had a course that ran through the whole first year. And it started with quantum mechanics, and it was a great man a week. And we ended with cultural anthropology, and you had to write a paper a week, a short paper on whatever the subject of the week was, and then you had to write a big paper. And I was going to write a paper on neural basis of learning and memory, and I started reading, and it was just a jungle. And so I thought it was going to take me forever. And I went to Floyd Ratliff, who had been my advisor. And he left Harvard and went to Rockefeller. And he was in Hartline's laboratory. And Hartline and Floyd were Kepfer Hartline and Floyd were my advisors in graduate school, just by chance. And I asked him if there were any puzzling observations that he knew about that maybe I could make a theory about. And so he told me an interesting observation, and I went and made a theory about it and wrote my paper on the theory, and I didn't believe it for a second. But then I thought, well, maybe I'll go try it and see if I can do an experiment and test this theory. and I did, and I had never done an intracellular recording in my life before. I'd never done an experiment on Lemulosi before, and I went and someone told me how to do it, told me how to do stuff. I'd done a lot of experiments on cats, but nothing on Lemulus, and to show me how
Lemulus
to do
this being
horseshoe crab, yeah, and that Hartline worked on. And so I went and I did an experiment. And it worked the first time, and it said my theory was right, and so I knew I was out of there. And so I then went and just did courses until it was time to do my experimental work. Turns out that the experiment I did was a very hard one, and when I started doing them again, I could only do it maybe once a week. It was just total blind luck that it worked the first time. And if it had not worked, I would have said, well, I didn't believe the theory anyway, this is too much trouble, and I would have given it up. But just by enormous good luck, the first time it worked, and then it didn't work again for ages after that. I mean, I couldn't do the experiments that I had to do. They were hard experiments. And it just the first time was extremely just good luck. It was not skill, it was just dumb luck.
Right.
That happens a lot of times. The first time you do an experiment, it'll work, and for some reason, this has happened many times, and then you can't do it again. It takes a while, because you were just lucky the first time. And I don't know why that is.
So after the PhD, you go...
So then I went to the University of Washington.
In Seattle.
And was there for 12 years.
So how are your interests changing during this? Are you honing down? Are you focusing during this period on something like what you've been doing for the last?
So I have gone throughout my career. I have changed fields a number of times. And you mentioned giving advice to young scientists, and it's a very bad career strategy to change fields. And the reason is that when you change fields, then you very quickly lose credit for the things that you did in the first field, and it takes quite a while to establish yourself in the new field.
So I would have said that you were kind of a synaptic physiologist at one point.
Yes, but before.
And now you're a theoretical neuroscientist.
Yes, but before.
Before
I did that, I worked on the cat olfactory system. I was a central nervous system physiologist.
Right.
And then I switched to membrane biophysics, and did things related to membrane biophysics, and that was what I was best known for. So the thing that I was best known for at the time, and in some circles still, was I measured the conductance of a single channel the first time by using noise measurements, the theory and some stuff. So I did membrane biophysics, and then I shifted into synapses and synaptic plasticity, and then I shifted into synaptic mechanisms. But always, I was always thinking about central nervous system things. And so then when I finished the synaptic physiology that I wanted, so and every time what I do is I have some questions I want to answer. When I get those questions answered, then that's when I change fields. So I answered the questions that I was interested in synaptic physiology, and then I went to something else, and that's when I started doing the theory. But I'd done theory all along.
But this period at the Rock must have been immensely important, because you're heavily reliant on math and physics.
Always, yes. So. Every step along the way, I've done it. But the kinds of theories that I did when most of my career were theories that were needed to connect the observations I made with what I cared about. So you measure fluorescence intensity. You don't care about the fluorescence intensity of some molecule, how much it fluoresces. What you care about is some more basic question, but you have to have a model that relates what you measure to what you care about. And I had always done that. But then I started, I did a year's sabbatical. I did theoretical physics for a year in Holland as a sabbatical. And I kept going back to doing physics, and I started maybe 15 years ago, going every summer to the Aspen Center for Physics, mm-hmm. and I would just go there and work, and also the Santa Fe Institute every summer. And I started relearning my physics and getting better at some mathematical techniques in physics that I had and applying it. And then so gradually I started taking an approach to theory that was different from what I had done before. And that is a more physics style approach where you identify things that have to be true and then derive consequences for those things.
Let's talk about the brain somewhat here. Let me throw a few things out to you from papers you've written and see if we can get a Stephen's tour of the brain, a primer, if you like, for people. First of all, some of the things that would surprise people are things like the unreliability of transmission at synapses, and how fault-tolerant things are, the redundancy and so on and so forth. That's probably a surprise to a layperson. They probably think it works like a computer to some extent. But as you point out in one of the pieces that you wrote for Current Biology, how does the speed of thought compare for brains and digital computers? You know, if you start comparing the number of transistors to the number of neurons and synapses and so on in human brain, I mean, it gets crazy, and you say, whereas a state-of-the-art microprocessor could have close to 30 kilometers of total wire connecting its transistors, the brain has, it's about 200,000, it's about the distance from here to the moon, as you said, in terms of the wire?
Yes.
Packed inside there?
Yes.
Which is, you know, extraordinary. It's a lot of wire. And you know, we look at things like, you then talk about things like scalability, scalable architecture. I mean, could you start building a little picture for me of?
Yeah, so the theoretical thing that I decided on to work on in the last time I changed fields from synapses to theory was to try to answer the question, what are the design principles that brains use to give their neural circuits a scalable architecture? Now, what that means is a scalable architecture is a computer circuit that you can make more powerful just by making it bigger, by adding more components to it. And Intel's architectures are not very scalable. Even if they change the thickness of the wire, they have to redesign a lot of the circuitry. And redesign the layout of the circuitry and things. They can't just make it bigger and have it work. But evolution requires that if you need more computing power, you've got to just be able to get it right away. If you make a bigger version of an animal and a smaller version, the bigger version has more skin surface to measure, has to have better vision and so forth, and so you need a computer that's going to do that, and you can't redesign it each time. You've just got to be able to have something that's designed so you make it bigger and then it works, and it works better, it works more efficiently. And so the thing I set out to do was to learn the design principles that brains use for getting these scalable architectures for their neural circuits. And it's a very general question. You have to think of specific examples. And my style of theory is very close to data. It's not general theories. It's theories that I hope to get general principles from, but always really, really close to the data and real problems that the brain has. And so one of the ways that scalability manifests itself is in something called allometric relationships, which are power laws between things that you can measure. So for example, if you count the number of neurons in the retina that are sending information to the brain, and if you count the number of neurons in the brain, in the primary visual cortex, that is processing that information, there is a power law relationship which says that the number of neurons that are processing the information is proportional to the number that are feeding the information to the 3/2 power. That's an allometric relationship, and there are many, many allometric relationships in biology. And those are often keys for understanding the scalability of neural circuits, because you have to be able to figure out why it's 3/2 rather than something else. Could be anything, but there's a reason why it's 3/2, and that gives you a clue about scalability. So that's the reason I started studying these allometric relationships, is to learn places that I might be able to develop questions to explain scalable architectures.
Right, and it says here the goal of your lab is to learn what classes of mathematical computations are carried out by neural circuits and what design principles govern the construction of these circuits.
That's right, because you have to have computations that are also scalable. You have to have a circuit that permits scaling up, but then you have to figure out computations that are being done that are also scalable.
The scalability and the allometry, you shifted. I mean, you're using the same principles, but there's the interesting recent Journal of Biology paper where Darwin and Huxley revisited and the origin of allometry. Yes. Would you like to talk about that? Because that's
yes. That paper came because I was in London the editor of the person that was the editor of that journal is a woman named Miranda Robertson that I've known for almost 50 years. I've known her just forever, and she took me out for breakfast, and we were chatting about things. And she said they were going to have a Darwin issue, and could I write something that was related to Darwin for the issue? And I said, gee, I don't know if I can think of anything, I'll try. And so I went home and sort of forgot about it, and then she reminded me, and so I thought of this as a way of relating something about Darwin. And the interesting thing is that the Huxley that was Darwin's bulldog, the main popularizer of Darwin's theories when Darwin was alive, was the grandfather of the Huxley that I wrote about there, and the Huxley that I wrote about was the founder, effective founder of the study of allometry. And he wrote a book on scaling relationships, allometric relationships in biology, and he found them all over the place. He found many power laws that relate size of body to length of claws and things like that that are not in crabs. One of the things he did, and this is Andrew Huxley, who was Aldous Huxley's brother, and the Hodgkin and Huxley half brother. Yeah. A very, very, very interesting family. Anyway, so when he published all of these power laws, and everybody said, well, yes, but they're probably just an approximation. They aren't, lots of times you get a straight line if you plot things on log plots. But the fact is that they seem to keep coming up all the time. Lots of power laws come up in biology, and they all look pretty good, a lot of them do. Some of them go over 10 orders of magnitude in size, just, you know, over giant ranges. And so I realized that there's a way that you could explain why the power laws kept coming up, and that way was that there is a basic design that gets used over and over again, but sometimes things get stretched a little bit, and there's a kind of mathematical function that has just those properties called a self-similar function. So I gave an example of why you always get power laws in biology.
What do you think are the key areas at this point? I mean, you have a piece here on synaptic plasticity, what's the brain basis of intelligence, that's a review. Systems biology versus molecular biology. I mean, where's the action going on at this point? Where do you think is the key place if you were coming into the field now where you'd want to go?
I've often wondered what it would have been like to live in Florence during the Renaissance. Because, the whole world is changing so fast there. And good perspectives are seen in paintings for the first time. The design of buildings is changing. The whole world is changing. And I've wondered what it would feel like to have been there at the time. And I think what's true is that it's the same for us now, except what's happening is not in the arts, but it's in science. Mm-hmm. That there's just been an enormous revolution that we've gone through. Everything is changing so fast. And the techniques that when I first came to Salk were unthinkable, 10 years later were standard, like making animals with particular genes altered. Making mice with particular genes altered. It was unthinkable in 1990, and by 2000, it was a standard thing. Everybody did it. And so things are changing so fast that I wouldn't know where I would want to go if I were just starting out. But there are some things that I can think of that are different, that are changing, and one is theory. Mm-hmm. That I think that the world is going to change because some kid is going to come along and have a really good theory of something in biology, and so that's one place the world would the world of biology will be totally revolutionized. I don't know where it's going to be, when it's going to be, but there's so many exciting areas it hardly matters.
You've been looking at, there's a paper here on predictable irregularities in retinal receptive fields, more recent things. You also did some stuff with Rusty Gage on astroglia-induced neurogenesis from adult yes. neural stem cells. I mean, so you apply this stuff in several different
areas. Yes, lots of different things. So in understanding scalable architectures, mm-hmm. you can have a power law. That's the rule that's being followed. For example, it doesn't have to be a power law; it could be something else. But you can find rules, and then there are two questions you need to ask. One is, why do you have that rule rather than some other rule, mm-hmm. and how does the brain achieve it? And so some of the things that I was talking about there were going in one of those other directions, that sometimes that you figure out, you find there is a power law, and then you have to figure out what the power law is good for, or you can do experiments to figure out, or collaborate on experiments to figure out why it is that power law, how that power law is achieved right. in during development. And so that's why some of those things seem so diverse.
A lot of these things are looking for general principles, so connectivity, optimization, the positioning of cortical areas, something yeah. to do with Klesko.
Yes. But
if you think back to your passion about Freud and so on, yeah. there's this dichotomous position where you have looking for general laws,
yes.
looking for a general description of the brain, looking for some sense of its modularity and so on and so forth, yes. and yet individual differences.
Yes.
And how to explain those? Is that something that you think about?
Well, so the thing that attracted me about Freud was that it was he had general principles. He had a theory of how the brain worked, and because I didn't pursue Freudian theory when I was an undergraduate. In fact, I was in a school that was very dismissive of Freud. But when I got to medical school, I understood exactly why it was, because when I was a third year medical student on psychiatry, everybody was given in the VA hospital their own schizophrenic to treat. And you're faced with this person who's really crazy, and you feel this enormous need for a rational way yourself for dealing with his craziness, and Freud, you fall right back on that. It's very compelling, because it gives you, the Freudian formulations give you a way of dealing rationally with a very disorganized person. So the Freudian theories haven't ended up being, they've been enormously successful in some ways, but they haven't really ended up as being good scientific theories. But I think the reason that I liked Freud in the very beginning was because it did offer general principles for something that otherwise seemed like it was too complicated to understand.
Yeah. So too complicated to understand makes me think immediately of consciousness. You actually, obviously Francis Crick was here when you came to the salt, although you would have met him before that if you were doing these regular visits to the...
Yes, in fact, one of the reasons that...
This wonderful obituary with Alex Rich,
yes,
in Nature, and you also did a piece, as I recall, on Crick and the claustrum, which was the area of the brain he was working on,
yes,
right to the last minute.
Yes.
Crick consciousness, and let me add that together with even current issues of Nature and so on, neuroscience and the mystery of free will, it's a piece that deals with consciousness and so on. Is this an area that interests you?
Yeah, I'm interested, of course. But
work map onto this or not?
It's something I'm interested in, but it's not something that it's something that I don't know how to deal with. Hmm. I don't know how you can get facts that relate to consciousness that you can explain. I have my own view of consciousness, which I'll tell you, which is not shared by very many people. And that is that, this is just my impression, I personally can't imagine consciousness without language and symbolic thinking. Hmm. If I hurt my thumb, I immediately start having a conversation with myself. Oh, is it badly hurt? Is the pain going to go on? What should I do to deal with the pain? Do I need to go see the doctor? Is my thumb broken? And I can't imagine my experience of the injured thumb could be the same unless I could have that conversation with myself. Now, we do thinking that is some sort of symbolic manipulations that does not involve language, but probably depends on the same brain area. So for example, everybody who does mathematics has the experience of having a problem, not being able to solve the problem, going to sleep, having a restless night, waking up and being able to solve it immediately in the morning. All night long, you were grinding away on this problem. You're asleep, but you're grinding away. And this happens very frequently. And everybody who does math has exactly the same thing. And so you can have symbolic thinking that doesn't involve language. But for me, you know, sometimes it involves a series of pictures or other less well-defined things. But for me, I just can't imagine consciousness the way I experience it without that. But I don't know, that's my feeling about how I experience
it. So are you therefore saying that you think that this is a uniquely human experience?
I believe in evolution, so I would think that there are that great apes do a certain amount of symbolic thinking. I think they do symbolic manipulation to some extent. They can kind of picture things in their mind, outcomes that are things that are coming. But I wouldn't think that consciousness, the way we know it, would be present without really high level symbolic manipulations. And so I would think that that there may be some vestiges of elements of consciousness in other animals, but I can't imagine without a lot of symbolic manipulation very much of it. But you know, how would you know if that's right or wrong? It's just more an opinion, and I don't know. I can't think of an experiment that one could do to find out if. Christoph Koch, there was a meeting that we had here at Salk, a little panel discussion on consciousness, and I made this point, and nobody else agreed with me. And Christoph said he was quite sure his dog was conscious, and because he reacts to the dog in a way that's very human. And I think they're probably, I haven't seen an iPhone 4S, but I think that there are probably some people with iPhone 4Ss who think that Siri is probably conscious. They say they want to marry her. So it's pretty hard to know exactly what qualities of consciousness you have that you would be able to do a scientific test and find out if it's there or not.
You must have talked to Francis about this, I suppose.
Yes, we talked off and on about it, but I didn't like to argue with him about things, and so I didn't mind things that he really cared about. I didn't like to argue with. I thought it was impolite, and so we talked about a lot of things, but we didn't talk a lot about his theories of consciousness.
Mm-hmm. That's you kind of answered to, or gave a partial answer to the old Peter Medawar book, Advice to a Young Scientist. I mean, would you like to amplify that? One thing you said is it doesn't help to keep on changing fields.
No, it's a bad career move. But sometimes you have no choices because your personality is such that you just can't do it.
But what are the pro things that you would advocate for people?
I think that. To be a successful scientist, you have to have a kind of craziness, a kind of madness. You have to like doing it so much that you can't imagine not doing it. And you don't worry about grants, you don't worry about tenure, you don't worry about jobs. You can't help yourself. And some people have that craziness, and some people don't. But people want to be a scientist sometimes, but if you don't have that intense desire, that feeling you can't do anything else actually, then you shouldn't do it. It's not going to work. And the people it works for the best are the ones who just love doing it. They can't not do it.
A question I ask everybody is the role of the relationship between science and society. That's mm-hmm. what the Science Network deals in primarily. And I remind people that when he came into office, President Obama said that his administration would restore science to its rightful place. What do you think the rightful place of science is?
So we're in a terrible funding situation now, and it's only going to get worse. And I read in the paper that Italy's rates for interest rates for borrowing is getting upwards to 7% now. It's really close, and they have a gigantic debt, and that's likely going to have ripples. And so it's going to be a long time before our economy is healthy again. And it may be that we need long-term to spend money on science. We certainly do. Everything that's of any value has come through, any monetary value has come through science. It's come through innovations of some sort or other that ultimately depend on science. But when people are starving, you may have to put off doing what's good for the long term and do things for the short term that are going to be bad for the long term. So I think that's happening now. Also, since the Second World War, biology has been growing exponentially. And it's been doing wonderfully. It's remarkable. But society isn't willing to expand funding forever exponentially. And so I think we're going to be facing a time of retrenchment, and to the point where Obama may want to restore science to its rightful position, but I think it's unlikely that the society is going to go along with it. And so I think it's not all bad. It's not a bad thing to have pressures to make science that are bad for science. I can give you a specific example. So when I first started looking for a job, I went to a medical school, and nobody who had choices would have gone to a college biology department. Because all the best people, not really all, but it seemed like all the best people were in medical school departments. And those were the places where you did the least teaching, you had the most time for research, you had the best colleagues, and so everybody wanted to be in a medical school, physiology, cell biology, molecular biology department. Nobody went to biology departments who were the best. Now that's always not true, but it's not a bad generalization. Then, as things started getting tighter with money quite a while back, then people started making the decision of going to biology departments where they had to teach more in order to have more freedom for not having to get as many grants and things. And now the biology departments are as good or sometimes better than the corresponding medical school departments. So that has been a consequence. That shift from medical schools to biology departments has been a shift that's dependent on basically increased difficulty with getting funds. And it's a healthy thing. It's good. And I think there'll probably be some other good things like that. These things are complicated problems, and it's hard to say. If I were in charge, yeah, I'd give a lot of money to science. But I do a lot of things, and I'm not sure it would be, I'd be doing the right thing always.
So what do you think about the role of the Salk in all of this?
Well, I think that Salk has been a fantastic institution. It's a place where you can go and just do research, which is wonderful. If you're in a university, you spend a lot of your time on committees, on, even if you're in a medical school department, there's a lot of stuff, a lot of bureaucracy, a lot of reviewing of things, a lot of being on committees of one kind or other that keeps you away from science. And having a place like Salk or Rockefeller, where what you do is you go there and you just do your work, is very important. It's important there be places like that. But Salk has financial problems, and the medical schools have financial problems, and they're all going to get worse because there's going to be a constriction of the amount of money available just because there's not enough to go around. And we've grown faster than society is willing to, even in good times, to support us, because over my career there has been a lot of fluctuations in funding support, but it's been very gradually going down. When I first started my first job, you couldn't not get a grant. Every time you applied for a grant, you got one. There were a few people, there were some mistakes, but basically people made mistakes sometimes and they didn't get their grants, but essentially everybody got every grant they applied for. It was very easy. And now maybe 1 in 10 people apply for grants, they get it. And that's not going to go away. We're stuck with it. And so Salk has to figure out a way of dealing with the decreased funding. And I don't know what their plan is. I don't know how they're going to do it.
It's a remarkable intellectual environment, though, isn't it?
Oh, yes. Yeah, it's one of the wonderful colleagues. And when I came from Yale, when I first came here, you know, you adapt to these things after a while, but I felt this enormous relief. Every day I went into work and all I did was I just did my research. I didn't have to worry about anything. I'd been a department chairman at Yale, though, you see, so that took a lot of time. I had problems to deal with there that took time away from my research. And I enjoyed it, and it was, I loved it. The people I had were wonderful. We felt like we were the first molecular neurobiology department in the country. And we felt like we were pioneering. There was wonderfully smart people, extremely good, very exciting times, very beginning of using molecular biology and neuroscience. But it took a lot of time away from my research. And so I noticed that when I would go away in the summer, I was so content. And then I would come back and I would have, every once in a while, I remember I would declare a period of self-indulgence. A period of self-indulgence maybe was a weekend, maybe a week sometimes, 2 weeks occasionally, when I didn't exist. I didn't have to answer my phone. I didn't have to write a letter. I didn't have to see anybody. I just worked. But then afterwards, I paid for it for months. I couldn't get any work done, any research done for months. And when I came to Salk, I suddenly just did nothing but research every day. It was fantastic. But then you adapt. You get used to it. You know.
If I gave you a time travel token that allowed you to bring to your dinner table anybody from any period of history, any discipline, whatever. Yeah. Is there anybody you'd love to sit down and have a conversation with and ask questions of?
Oh, yeah. But probably tops of my list would be kind of trite things like Newton and Einstein. Because I'd like to, I get a sense of what kind of people they were. They, because quite a few of the most famous people, scientists now, I've been around long enough that I know. I knew Francis. I know Jim Watson very well. I spent a lot of time with him. And so I have a very good sense of the, of some of the great people, but I have very little sense of Newton, for example, people who've changed the world, Galileo, Copernicus, and people who have really changed our view of the world enormously. I'd love to have a sense of what kind of person they were.
Anybody from the arts?
Well, you know, the year that I spent in Holland on my sabbatical doing physics research, doing theory and physics and statistical mechanics, I had a hobby which was 17th and 8th century Dutch art. And so there's wonderful Dutch art that I had known about a little but never spent any time with. And so I spent a lot of time reading and going around to the museums and reading about these things. And so I would truly like to know Vermeer. Mm-hmm. And you know, the paintings are just incredible. Mm-hmm. And also Rembrandt. Mm-hmm. was amazing.
Self-portraits.
Yes.
Over time.
Yeah, they're, it's just, and everything he did, you know, he just couldn't help himself. The things he did were just so beautiful.
Well, that's one of the interesting things that I talked to Terry Sanofsky about this yesterday, the persistence of self-construct over time.
Yes.
The fact that every time you access a memory, you slightly change the adaptive representational network, if you want to call it that. Yeah. How does a coherent self-construct persist over time, if it's being changed all the time? This is something that you think about?
Yeah, except I don't know how to think about it very well. So, I mean, it's like consciousness. I sort of think how what I would think about this a little bit, and I think, well, you know, I can't imagine it without language. That's my vision of it, but that's not the very sensible thing. And so I also wonder about, you know, how we, one of the central problems that I don't see any solution to coming in anytime soon is how memories are represented. I can believe that we can understand the molecular mechanisms behind memories. We ultimately will. But how you represent a memory, what form is your face represented in my brain, and how we would do that. And how they might be possibly represented and how retrieved. Those are very hard problems. And those are problems because memories get reorganized over time. Yeah. And so those are part of the relationship to the change of self.
I got a last question for you, but just to interpolate one little thing. When I was trying to remember the person that I was thinking about with, who was so much associated with allometry. And it was the Growth and Form book. It was Darcy Thompson.
Darcy Thompson, right.
So, yes. Again, so that was an interesting. So last question would be, what are you optimistic about?
What am I optimistic about? Well, you know, I'm a generally probably unrealistically optimistic person. and so I'm excited about the things I'm working on at the moment always, and I'm optimistic they're going to work out well. I'm optimistic that the ups and downs in society will ultimately get better, and I'm optimistic about lots of things that are potentially exciting will be really changing the world. I'm optimistic that somebody is going to come along and upend neurobiology with a theory. Some kid is going to come and find some question to ask and some answer that nobody has ever thought of and just change it completely.
Now, when that happens, we'll come back and have a conversation about what you think about it. Chuck Stevens, thanks very much.
Thank you, Roger. That was fun.